This episode of the pod's proudly brought to you by J. Beck Mechanical Repairs. With the ever-rising cost of living, we're all looking for ways to save a few bucks so you can spend it in the areas that you love. One area J. Beck can help you is with the rising cost of fuel prices. Why not remap your vehicle to gain more power and better fuel economy through their chip tuning service? Chip tuning can be done on many vehicles, including various trucks and tractors, and conditions apply. With over 30 years combined experience in small engine cars and diesel engines, Jade and his team are qualified in both diesel and petrol vehicles. They offer a mobile field service unit including breakdown services, all mechanical repairs, engine rebuilds, as well as aircon and auto electrical services. To find out more, just find J. Beck Mechanical Repairs on Facebook, email jbeckinvestments@gmail.com, or call or text 0492 594 058. Tell them Brendan sent you for a free cuddle, and trust me, that's better than a handshake, because Jade's fingers will crush you. J. Beck Mechanical Repairs, offering chip tuning. Unleash the power within. On this week's show, champion cricketer and Latrobe boy, Trent Keep. Most will know Trent as a prodigiously talented batsman who scored tons of runs and was unlucky not to get a start with the Tasmanian Sheffield Shield side. This chat opens up another side to Trent which many don't know. The young boy who based his self-worth on whether he scored runs and eventually grew into a man who at times suffered with crippling anxiety and mental health issues as a result. Trent speaks about his early initiation into cricket, successes and failures which both contributed to his struggles, his darkest days and how he coped with things. We speak about how moving to South Australia became a wake-up call to his issues and how moving home to Latrobe first felt like a huge failure but ultimately led him to getting on top of things with the unwavering support of the few who knew about his challenges. This is a fascinating insight into how someone who can seem on top of their game, highly successful and confident, can be struggling on the inside, because as the saying goes, just because you carry it well doesn't mean it isn't heavy.
Welcome back to the Talk Hard Podcast. I'm Jake.
I'm Briley.
I'm Sonny.
We hope you enjoy today's episode.
I've got half an opportunity here. I'm going to take it this time.
He sat there for two songs and he goes, he likes to shit up, and then he left.
When I die, I want everyone to have shots and I want you to use my coffin as the bar.
But I collapsed and they couldn't find a heartbeat for a couple of minutes.
I would give everything, anything that I've got right now to hear my mum sing again.
Could just go into the house and do it and no one would care, but people do care.
He said, thank you for saving my life.
The Talk Hard Podcast with Brendan Hinkson.
Oh, mate, it doesn't get much bigger than this.
Trent Keep, welcome to the Talk Hard Podcast, mate.
Thank you. Thanks, Brendan. Thanks for having me, mate. I just before we obviously started recording, I've been a huge listener. I most recently listened to the Nick Haywood podcast and I just thought, wow, like what a thing that you guys are doing. And obviously, secondly, just Nick's podcast was amazing. I just thought, like, I probably played one game of competitive basketball in my life. that was in grade six.
Yep.
I had one job. I got subbed off in about 20 minutes in terms of fouled out.
Yep.
Fouled out. But I just thought, gee whiz, I can't shoot, pass or defend, but I would play basketball for Nick Haywood. And I just thought, you know, it really gave me probably the courage to step up. And when you messaged me about coming on, I just thought this is the time to share some stuff. And I guess my story on an inverted commas a career, that's a bit glorified, but yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
And mate, so we're talking to you from London today. So we know that the Talk Hard Podcast's gone far and wide now. You're actually our second guest.
It has, yeah.
Second guest from England behind Bakesy's. He'll probably be listening to this as well. But yeah, so how long have you been over there for, mate?
I've been here just on 4 months now. I had a few visa issues. I'm director of coaching at a club here in London, which is just down the road from where I'm taking, obviously, the podcast I'm from, called Eastcote. They're actually called the Eastcote Squirrels, which I find in terms of sporting names is up there. But awesome opportunity to come over here and take on such a prestigious and high-end leadership role in terms of overseeing pretty much most of the programs within the club. And it's something that I'm quite fond of, and it's going well to date. It's never perfect, but yeah, learn a heap about myself, man management, leadership and backing yourself, really, in terms of this is probably, I've been coached at some good cricket clubs before, but you don't have to perhaps do all the managing of the board and all that sort of thing. So it's been good to learn both skill sets and hopefully we finish the year well.
And yeah, we've got you pretty early, mate. Like you've saying there before off air that you're an early riser. What is it, about 5:30, 6 a.m. at the moment over there?
Yeah, just on 6 a.m., just yep. about. So I usually get up at about this time anyway. That's from obviously living in Queensland for the last couple of years. You get your body clock when the sun's coming out when it's hot to get up. But they laugh at me every day here that I go to the Greek club. What time did you get up today? And I say 6, and they're just like, man, you're mad. But they get up at like 9 o'clock. They roll into work at like 9:30.
Yep.
Different lifestyle.
Once it warms up a bit. Mate, so obviously we'll get into your story. So, you know, a lot of people that listen to this would know a little bit about your story, but I'll let you tell it. Grew up in La Trobe?
Yeah, I grew up in La Trobe. I went to school in Devonport. I went to Nixon Street Primary.
Yep.
I grew up as one of three. So I've got an older brother, Ryan, a younger brother, Luke. You know, and I think growing up with two brothers was my first step into competing and, I guess, punching above your weight. But yeah, we grew up in the tribe on some land, just like regular kids, really. We kicked footy, soccer, cricket in the summer. Mum and dad worked at the pulp mill, which a lot of people did at the time.
Yep.
Shift work. He was involved at numerous footy clubs in coaching capacity. And I think he probably set in stone now when I look back, well, the wheels in motion for me to want to be a coach in some capacity. But we just grew up around the footy, really. I'd go to the footy in the winter all day, watch the under-19s all day, you know, drink cans of Coke, go home, go to bed. And then in summer, when I wasn't playing cricket, or I'd play my junior stuff in the morning and then go watch Ryan and my Uncle Paul play La Trobe first grade and spend all day there. Again, it's almost like, who's going to pick Trent up from home?
Yep.
Mum and Dad would put me in the car with one of the players, and I would like either pack up kits at the end of the day, the cans of Coke, or I'd just like be 12th man. And then my dream as a kid was to play first grade for La Trobe. I still got it. In my year 7, like, you do careers class, what our dream is, and mine says in poor handwriting, might I add, to play first grade for La Trobe. So very humbling to look back at, very humbling. And yeah, just grew up, went to St. Brendan's, pretty normal childhood. I didn't miss out on too much. I was very fortunate. Dad worked hard, mum worked hard, had every opportunity to be successful, I suppose, without, you know, we weren't super wealthy, but yeah, I can't come on and say that I had a difficult upbringing, because realistically it was pretty good, and I'm very grateful for them for that.
Excellent. And you mentioned your family there before, mate. It's obviously a pretty good pedigree. Like, there's not anyone really in your family that can't sort of put their hand to something and be pretty bloody good at it, is there? So what's that all about?
Yeah.
How did your old man used to go?
Yeah, Dad played a little bit of cricket, but it was mostly footy. And I think Ryan and Luke, to be honest, they're more flexible in terms of the sporting stuff. I played a little bit of football. Don't have the same height as them. Don't necessarily have the same natural ability. But yeah, we are. Mum played netball and stuff growing up. So I did find at, you know, pretty early age that from hand-eye and sporting and stuff that you could kind of just pick it up and do it. But it was cricket that I gravitated towards greatly. Obviously playing in the backyard started that. Playing with my Uncle Paul, who was captain of La Trobe first grade at the time, his mates would come around. And if I would field all day, I would get one bat. So if I got out, like, that was it. That was it. So
you had to value your wicket.
I just blocked. Yeah, I just blocked. And that, I always say to him, he cost me more runs because they didn't let me bat, so I could never play any shots. So when I got to about 20 and people were like, mate, you're allowed to hit the ball, I was like, well, no way. I'm not getting out. Like, I spent so many days in the dirt field in the backyard.
Yep.
No way. I'm going to bat for as long as I can. So.
Yeah. Speaking of your Uncle Paul, I've had contact with him before too. He's hesitant to come on for a chat, but he'd be a fantastic story. So if he's listening, mate, I'm still after you.
Yeah, hopefully he comes on, because he is a student of the world. And a lot of my, I guess, leadership qualities that I developed early on playing under him at La Trobe, when I was, you know, I think I played my first grade game at 13 or 14. And I just remember that Thursday, like, David Squibb, who's a legend of the club, just said, mate, you're going to play first grade. And I just went home and, like, packed my bag Thursday night, went to school the next day, like, buzzing. Like, I'm thinking, this is it. This is the Ashes. Like, we're playing. I think my debut was Devonport at La Trobe. So that was like the mecca, you know, you're playing at La Trobe on that big oval against Devonport, who had a formidable team. And on that Saturday, I was just so excited to play. Like, batted 9, fielded fine leg to fine leg.
Yep.
Got it back, got like 13 not out or something, but it was ruthless. Like, it was no holes barred. That was it for me. It was so good.
You just mentioned there before, so you were 14 when you made your debut. Is that correct?
Yeah. Wow. So I played second grade a lot of that summer. I kind of just bypassed. At that point, there was third grade as well. I know there's not on the coast anymore, which is a shame, but
yep.
I sort of just jumped up from – I'd been playing under 17 cricket, which was fourth grade at that time with Ryan's team for, you know, quite often you'd have guys that had just turned, you know, 16, 17, and they weren't available every weekend. So I'd pack my kit every Sunday and just hoping – well, I was hoping someone wouldn't turn up and I would play.
Yep.
And then – I just, I played second grade and I didn't score a great deal of runs, but I think I showed enough in terms of, I guess, attitude and mental aptitude and technique that they just thought we're going to play him in first round, batting down the order. And, you know, I think within 5 or 6 weeks of that first season, I'd gone up the order because I'd been not out quite a bit. So that was probably what hardened me, and I'm sure we'll get into it as the podcast goes on. That certainly played a part in any of the success that I've been able to have as a player in terms of that hardened exterior that you had to have. And it probably set the first building block in terms of the mental health struggles that I would have down the line because of the relationship I put on by being really tough, really hard, unflappable young kid had developed. And it's my fault and mine only, but it had developed into, you know, a really hardened young adult who probably wasn't willing to show any emotion and relied purely on being good in a sense at cricket, how he was viewed by other people in the world. So very grateful for the opportunity. Wouldn't change a thing, but real proud to have played. My first grade number was 323, so we'll never forget it.
Yeah. And you say obviously coming in at the age of 14, were there certain challenges within that as well? Like, did they go after you? Was there like any sort of sledging because you were such a young fella? Like, were there any, can you explain any sort of extra challenges you had as a young bloke?
Yeah, I remember we played Sheffield up at Sheffield. Yep. And that, again, in terms of away trips of cricket that I've had in throughout or all over the world, that was almost as tough as I think it gets. And Craig Boucher was playing, who's obviously got, you know, a million wickets at an average of about six. He's got everyone out about 97 times.
Yeah.
And I'm just this young kid. And I, admittedly, I strutted around when I was batting. Like, I walked around like Kevin Peterson. I thought I was all it, like.
Yeah.
And that was part of it. That, for me, that was part of getting up and getting into the game. And I just think Craig politely or impolitely said, you know, I'm not sure you should be the one strutting around with those watermelon under your arms and a few expletives one day. And I just thought, wow, like, how good is this?
I'm in the big time.
Awesome. I'm in the big time. Like, this guy is like, at that point, he was Pat Cummins to me. Like,
yep,
he was the best cricketer. Like, I had Tim Irvine at short leg. All these greats of the game, the Slips, like all these people that I admired from afar. Found myself in the middle of Sheffield Oval, felt like Lords.
Yep.
You know, I've got Tim Irvine at short leg, like I said. He's almost whispering Ash Craig's at the top of his mark, like, keep going, mate. Like, this is great to see. Keep fighting it out. And then Craig would bowl a ball and he'd be like, man, I'm not sure you should be working around with that. Like, I'm going to hit you in the head. Like, that swagger. What have you got if we play two games? Like, it was brilliant. I'll never forget. Oh, yeah. I talk about it with Latrobe boys every time I get back there. I said, geez, remember that time we played Sheffield with Bouch? And it's just like, a smile comes over my face. And that was it for me. That was... If I would have passed away, you know, it sounds stupid. At the end of that game, I would have been a happy kid.
Yep. And, mate, like, you touched on a few of your struggles there before, and obviously we will get into it. And the reason being is that you said to me, even at that early age of around 14 and 15, you started to develop a little bit of a connection between being talented at sport and who you were as a person, which at the time you didn't realise, but now you look back, it was very unhealthy. Can you explain that time for us?
Yeah, certainly that time I thought that I was a better is a bad word, a more respected, I guess, individual if I was talented at sport. And I was very fortunate that I wasn't really the hardest trainer, to be honest, mate. I got cricket from a young age and I would learn to train harder as I got older. But certainly I, looking back, thought that if I was scoring runs or playing first grade or making state teams, that meant that I was someone.
Yep.
As a, you know, walking down the street, people cared more about me because I was talented.
Yeah.
And it's really difficult to sit and say that you were talented, but I think it was clear from a, you know, a coastal perspective that I had some ability.
Yeah.
And I just attached that to the importance of almost I'll be more loved or more sought after from, you know, relationships and things like that if I'm talented. And I look back now, I just think that was the moment that it started for me, and it only probably got worse as the level got better. Yeah. And the pressure with that come higher, mate. So certainly, and I've sat with a couple of psychologists now and dissected all of it from a young age. And that's no one's fault. No one, mum and dad weren't like, oh, mate, you got to get runs or no one's going to love you. That was the opposite.
Yeah.
And that's what almost makes it harder when I look back is the strain and stress that it maybe made them question, did we put too much importance on it? I just want to say, like, especially mum, nah, no way. Like, I've got to own, stand up and own that part of the journey. But yeah, I certainly, you know, I would go to, in the end, when I went to play Hobart cricket at 18, I would like not go to school on Fridays or miss out on half a day so I could get down there in time and prepare. So there was a few things that, look, I think if we went back, it'd do a bit different, but who wouldn't?
Yeah. Did you have a backup plan? Obviously, cricket was the be-all and end-all at a young age, but did you have anything like as a backup that if this doesn't work out, this is what I want to do with my life?
No, I don't. I still don't. I do now. I've got so many interests outside the game in terms of that. But at the time, no. I just thought, like, you know, and again, growing up on the coast, as you know yourself, it's not, I mean this with all due respect, you're not, I was probably talented there, but I found out quickly when I went south to play in Premier League cricket, like I was just one of 40 kids who perhaps had the ability to play for Tasmania. And that was eye-opening in itself. So it's kind of like, well, gee whiz, like, this is a big time now. But no, I had no backup. I just wanted to play cricket like, for Tasmania. That was it.
Yeah. And looking back now, obviously there's probably other, you know, young kids around that same age now that are very sporting mad. As you say, like Northwest Coast, it's a big, you know, heartland for sport. Do you see the importance now in having that balance? Like, obviously you've got to enjoy your sport and you've got to be trying to be the best at it, but you also need to have that balance and something outside of it. What sort of advice would you give to them now?
Yeah, absolutely. That's something I'm so proactive in sharing. If people ask, it's very hard to just slide into some talented, you know, sportsman's messages and say, hey, mate, make sure you got a backup. But a few people have reached out. Now I coach more and my focus is on that. I'm dealing with players that are on the fringe of having careers. I'm just so, you know, the exact same as Nick Haywood, checking in with them, making sure that they are, you know, not necessarily studying. It's very difficult to say to someone who's perhaps on the cusp of a professional contract, make sure you're going to school, mate, like that. They're not going to hear that. But I think with mum and dad in stepping out, you know, with their parents stepping out, what they feel as though they're interested in and keep exploring that. What I've found now is that if you have other interests, it makes the game so much more enjoyable. But I guess the advice is to train your backside off, but have a plan B, because the cruel reality is it's very, very difficult to make it as a professional athlete, as we all know. Now, not everyone's doing it. Cricket in particular, you need the players that are above you to be going poorly. And you need to be scoring runs at the right time.
Yep.
But definitely, I don't know whether I would have went straight out of school and went to uni or anything. I think that's difficult to answer. I never really didn't really enjoy the classroom too much, but I do wish sometimes that I maybe had studied and had, say, a teaching degree or something behind me. But at the time, you make decisions based on, you know, your heart and head, and we decided to go that way. And I don't think I would change it.
Yep. And you said that what were the signs, like, when you said that you valued your self-worth on whether you were making runs and things like that? Like, if you did have a bad game or you weren't sort of, you know, if you weren't really flourishing with the bat at the time, were you sort of down in the dumps? Did other people notice that you had a bit of a change in your demeanor?
I think as I got older and obviously got to about 20 and 22 and that, and we'll dwell on that shortly, that my parents started to notice a change in personality. But at a younger age, no, not particularly. I think they just, you know, at that age, you're maturing obviously physically and mentally as well. So I think it probably got disguised a little bit in obviously growing up as becoming a young man and that sort of thing as well. I never lashed out, but I noticed that I probably wasn't as outgoing or keen to go into social settings if I hadn't performed. Which, you know, I'm on the other side of the fence now and I live with anxiety and manage it pretty well now. So when I say it, like, it makes me, I'm almost a bit ashamed about it, honestly, how I had wound myself into viewing the world like that. A bit sad, a bit ashamed, and it's a bit difficult to speak about. But that's generally how it was at the time. Like, I would almost like avoidance or retreat a fraction, but you're still able to stay connected now because you've got a phone. So no one really, you know, could say, no, I'm a bit tired, I'm not going to go. Like, it's a pretty easy throwaway line.
Yeah. But you felt like you couldn't sort of show your face if you weren't burned successful. You thought people were looking down on you, did you?
Yep, I couldn't have said it any better. Yep.
And you said that in our notes there before, you reckon it was about 22, 23 that it really started to really affect you and start to, for lack of a better word, become a bit of an anxiety disorder sort of thing. Like it really started to take its toll.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Tell us about that time, mate.
So I'd played really well for 2 years at South Hobart Sandy Bay in the Premier League. I'd won. I was in the team of the year. I'd played. That was the season I made my second 11 debut as well, just after the Philip Hughes tragedy. So got a game, got 100 against Canberra, they were at that time.
Yep.
At Marnick Grove, I was playing with like Ben Dunk, Luke Butterworth. From a kid that grew up on the trail, this was it. Like, you're going out for dinner every night at the end of the play, and then managed to get 100. And I thought, oh, this is it. Like, I've got to get a rookie contract now. A lot of people were probably saying, yeah, mate, you're going to get a crack, that sort of thing. And I generally believed I was. But long story shorter, I didn't get one at the end of that home summer. And I kind of just remember sitting down. I had a manager at this time, Greg Size, who I still have now. But we weren't that close at this point in time. He would become the first person that I probably truly opened up to about my mental health struggle when I get to Adelaide. But I decided with him and my parents and stuff that, and again, some communication with Cricket Tasmania, that perhaps there weren't going to be the opportunities on a list there. And then looking at the list strength, like there was a number of guys that would just change coaching staff. So I decided to go to Adelaide. So again, looking back, I was putting all this importance on, like, if I didn't make it to play for South Australia, I was going to see that as a failure. And look, I went to a really good club. There was really good people. It was no one's fault other than my own, really. I put so much importance on it. And I just remember getting to about halfway through the year and thinking, like, that was the first time I'd had any physical symptoms to do with anxiety. And I'd been to a number of doctors almost to, like, you know, when I get anxious, like, my whole body would break out into like this red rash, mate. And I mean, like, it was so red. And for a young guy who always enjoyed like looking good, that sort of thing, I'm not ashamed to say, like, I wanted to look good. I wanted to be, attractive and that sort of thing. I'm not surprised that I copped a physical, I'm not surprised I copped a physical, symptom. But it would like break out all over me. And the first time it ever happened, I was having an argument with, I was seeing someone at the time, so I was having an argument with them. I just remember thinking, God, like, what? I'm off my head here. Like, what's going on? And I remember going to a doctor and they kind of said, oh, you've probably had like a skin irritation to like, washing powder or something. So, all right, there was about 7 specialists that I went and seen about. I was looking for a physical, I was looking for anything to say it wasn't like inside me, it wasn't mental.
Yep.
And then, I actually played okay that summer, but I put so much emphasis on, making it for South Australia. I'd been cut out of the second team squad. That hurt. And I just remember thinking, poor, I'm not sure things are great here. Mum and Nan came over to watch the cricket, they said, but I think it was more probably to check up on, Mum's middle son. And I just remember, like, we're having this breakfast at their Airbnb in North Adelaide, and it all just come out. I started crying in front of Mum. I said, I don't know what the F's going on, like, and that was tough.
Yeah.
That was tough to see her without the answers. Her Mum's like a warrior, right? Everyone gets on and says I love their mum, and I think Mum's the best. But to see her in almost despair and without any answers and unable to help at that time was pretty tough. And she was the first person I sort of said, look, I don't think things are great. And then the second conversation I had was with Greg, my manager, and I said, oh, I need to go home at the end of the summer and, back out of this second year. And, that at amateur sport, it's not a financial thing to get out of it. It was more just like, this is what I'm struggling with. I just remember him being like, mate, like, we're all here for you, cricket or not, like, as a human being, and just so heartwarming. But little did I know it was probably going to get a bit worse when I got back to Tasmania and that. But, that was a tough conversation to have with both of them.
So you said there before, mate, just take us back to, again, back to your anxiety itself. Was it only when you didn't score runs, or did it, over time, did it start to
manifest just in daily life? Like, even if you did score runs, you were still feeling a bit anxious and down. Did it turn into anything like that at all, or was it just basically around performance?
No, it crept into everything I was doing, like 24/7, every day. It didn't matter. So after the Adelaide summer, obviously I come home. My parents, I remember the plane ride. So dad has some time off work. He come over. We pack all my stuff up. We're driving to the airport. We're obviously getting on a plane. Doesn't take a genius to work out, but like, I'm having all this biggest anxiety attack on the plane. Like, and it sounds so stupid now. Like, so it's cringeworthy to say. I thought like everyone on the plane was looking at me like a failure. Like, there's that bloke that went to South Australia and couldn't fucking make it. That's generally how I felt. And I'm having this panic anxiety. I used to call it a panic attack because I wanted to avoid the world, but it's an anxiety attack. My nervous system's going to shit. I'm bright red, like all over me. And I just remember dad and I talk about it now with, you know, a little bit of humor. And it's not, at the time, it was the worst thing that had ever happened to me. And again, you also know when you're going through that, like, people have it so much worse off. Like,
yeah.
You're not naive to think that you're the only person that is dealing with something, but he just thought I was going to jump out of the plane. That's honestly what he thought. Like, yep. I'm bright red. And he was like, mate, you're so red. Like, he's just like, how many minutes left on this plane? Cause I can't get into Devonport in.
Yep.
And I remember landing in Devonport. There's a couple of people, obviously it's a very small airport for those who are far and wide, tiny. There's like one gate.
Mm.
There was like five or six people I knew there. And I just like ran straight out of the airport. I was like, I can't wait for my bags. Like, I need some fresh air. And that's when it had started to be 24/7. Didn't matter whether it was, I'd scored 110, was at the gym, was just at home. It was 24/7, high wired, breakout at any moment. Really, really needed to rewire my brain at the time. But get home from Adelaide, have a bit, you know, I enrolled in a uni course. Mum was pretty big on that, which was actually teaching. And I think she knew deep down I was never going to stick it out. But I think for her, it was a real purpose to get up each day to at least study at home. And, you know, it was affecting me there. I remember we were doing like a presentation, which at that point in time, that was my idea of a nightmare, like getting up in front of people like as a failure. And again, like, breaks out. And I said to my uni class, like, right now I'm in the middle of an anxiety attack. Like, how fucking embarrassing. I shouldn't swear, but how embarrassing. And I just ran out of the Burnie campus in my car and drove home from Burnie to Denver. Like, that's it. Left all my stuff there. Left it all there. Like, it was like flight or fight. And now, as I look back, and obviously I then went to see psychologists and stuff, which we'll get onto. But I understand now the reaction I was having with my body. But at the time, I was just like, I'm going insane. Like, I can't live like this. Yeah. But I checked my school emails the next day. Like, how am I going to go back there? Like, how am I ever going to go back in that class? I would have had like 12 emails from people and staff at the uni saying how brave to admit that, so strong. And that was probably the first time, without even knowing it, because I'm in the worst of it there, that sharing could be beneficial to other people and yourself. That was the first moment. But I look back now, and that's the first moment. But at the time, I was just like, oh, I can't go back to uni now.
Yeah.
I did go back, and it happened again.
Yeah, it's a funny thing you say though. Like, I know you're obviously in a leadership position now, and you're really big on leadership. But that is one of the key signs to leadership, I find, is being vulnerable, because you actually give other people permission to open up and talk about their stuff as well. Yeah. And I think that's what happened with your school, didn't it?
Yes, yeah, 100%. And that's a big thing for me. When we do get onto leadership and that, being vulnerable is, you know, examples like. There's been days where I've been captain and I've just, after the game, said, look, I got that wrong. Like,
yep.
I got that decision wrong, boys. I'm really sorry. I tried my best on that. Certainly when I was coach on the Gold Coast, that was a big thing I wanted to bring. And there was players that felt like they could open up to their coach and about their life. Not to get too off topic, but yeah, that to me, I always, every time I take a job or go to a club in a position of power, like coach or director of coaching, I want the career club or the club that I'm in to be someone's reason to live. And that's how I said, want to set it up, and that's how I judge it on the success of, would this place, numbers wise, if you've got, you know, 300 people there, someone is clinging to life probably in their own head.
Yeah.
Will this place be there to keep them alive?
How scary is it in this day and age how much we rely on modern technology?
It's not till your phone dies or the Wi-Fi or power goes off that you realise you'd be lost without it. Well, recently my phone decided in its old age to die and stop charging, and on a weekend no less. So what do? Rather than waiting to speak to the network providers or retail outlets, which can be painful within itself, give Brad or Katie a call at Greenies Apple Repairs. That's what I did, and they had my old phone as good as new in hours. Greenies take care of iPhones, iPods, iPads, and pretty much everything else, and they won't cost you an arm and a leg. So next time you're stuck back in the dark ages with no technology, contact Greenies Apple Repairs on 0401 229 220, or you can contact them at www.greeniesrepairs.com.au or find them on Facebook. Now just to get onto this busted screen.
You spoke there before about, and we'll go into later on, about the help that you did eventually get. Going back though, like obviously you were saying when you flew over with your dad, he knew that you were anxious and things like that. So you'd obviously opened up to your parents. Like at what point did they know that you were really, really struggling?
I think mum got a quicker grasp on it. And again, looking back, like I keep saying, the strain it put on them too is the only thing. I wouldn't go back and change much of it, but I would go back and change the strain it put on them, because Dad was working at this point in time. He's fly in, fly out of Perth in the mine. He's getting a small glimpse of it, I guess, every 3 weeks. He's 2 weeks on, 1 week off. You know, so he's probably coming home thinking, you know, wanting to get some rest, but he's walking into like, fuck, like what friend am I going to get for this week? So it did put a dent on our relationship. And Dad was of the era of, let's go have a beer and talk about it. Good night's sleep. You'll be right tomorrow. And that's not saying that he didn't try or didn't care at all. I knew he loved me, but I really felt for him now looking back, because these days as a leadership role, I'm equipped one because I've been through it, but you learn more about it now. Mental health and anxiety and depression is almost at the forefront of every coaching course. How are you going to deal with a number of players who have these issues? But in his era, it was almost like a few beers, chat it out, off your chest, wake up tomorrow, brain will be back to normal again.
Yep.
So it did put, I think he was later to realise the severity. I think he thought, you know, come back, get on your feet, save a bit of money, get a job, that sort of thing, you'll be fine. And he won't have any issues with me saying that as well. He just wasn't equipped with, I guess, the same knowledge. And mum had that bit more compassionate side from her family and that. And she was living it like, you know, the small steps that we were creating. Dad was coming in then, obviously, 2 weeks later and being like, oh, nothing's changed. But we knew internally, I'd stepped out of my comfort zone a bit at uni. It happened twice. I'd open up about it. They were big, big wins. But I think mum knew, she would say now that she knew just from talking to me on the phone that maybe three or four weeks or, you know, 2 months into Adelaide that something was up.
Yep. And like you say, again, we'll go into when you did get help, but what strategies were you using at the time? Because it was like, how long was it? Like how many years did you deal with this before you actually got help, and how did you deal with it?
The real bad stuff I probably dealt with for that whole Adelaide summer. So you're looking at about 8 months on my own, but then I think back now to when I first started playing cricket and there were some signs there, but it wasn't controlling. There was no physical stuff there. There was none of the red rash or probably close to a year before I think mum made me go down to a psychologist who would turn out to be one of the most beautiful women, like just the most perfect human being. And it's funny because I used to joke around that I was a bit of it's a bad term, like a lemon, like a bit of a, I used to say, like, I'm just an absolute lemon. Like I can't go out for a beer without getting anxious. I can't do this without getting anxious. And then I go down to this psychologist, you know, office, and in the waiting room, it's just this big bowl of lemons. Like I just thought, like, come on.
Do you think they are strategically placed or?
So I don't know whether my mum had said that to make him laugh, but I just remember being like so anxious in there. I'm breaking out into this red rash again. I'm like, oh, what a place to do it. At least, you know, there's probably a few things going on in here. But I had this huge smile on my face, like ear to ear, this bowl of lemons. And she was like, what are you laughing at? And I was like, oh, you know what? If I told you, you wouldn't believe me. But we sat down, and for the first hour, I couldn't bring myself to say it. We just sat in complete silence.
Yep.
And she was great. She said, you don't want to talk about it, mate. You don't have to. But at this point, I'm on a mental health plan through my GP. So you kind of got to tick the box. You got to go. And it wasn't until the second session that I was just like, you know what, I've got to be here now. I want to get better. And everything just came out, like every minuscule detail of how I felt about myself as a person, how I felt about other people, how, you know, my upbringing and all that sort of stuff, which was great. Like, I just remember driving home after that one thinking, I think, you know, the psychologist was pretty open and honest. She was just like, look, there's no magic pill for this. That's the cruel reality. I can't give you this and it's going to be gone tomorrow, but we can make it manageable through hard work. And I just love the honesty in that. I take that honesty now into coaching, like that she gave me all the time, because I wanted to know what I was up against. At that point in time, I didn't really know what the hell was going on. I thought that, you know, maybe if I took more vitamins, that sounds stupid, but we're trying all these things.
Yep, diet.
Diet, not drinking. Never was a massive drinker during this or after it or before it, but we'll go out and have a few parties and stuff and go out with mates. But we tried all this stuff and nothing worked. And she's like, because it's within you, Trent. Like, it's you. And that wasn't like a blaming, saying it's your fault. It was more just like, we've got to start from the inside out. So I poured everything out. We put some steps in place, some things like dieting. And I would see her then for close to 20, 30 times throughout my life. And I just remember like the last time, and we're talking, at this point, I'm also coach of La Trobe Cricket Club, which was more, it sounds funny because people are like, oh, why didn't you stop playing? But to me, cricket had created a lot of this, but it was also who I was. So to walk away from it completely was like, well, then I'm completely a failure. Like,
yep.
At least if I can go and do well for La Trobe, I'm half a failure. That's that in my mind, and it sounds ludicrous now to see the world like that.
Yep.
But at that time, that's how I viewed it.
Yeah.
So we spoke about that a lot, the importance of, you know, not doing that for me. It was doing it for you guys like Ray Reid, who was curator, who's not with us anymore, all the people, mum and dad, all that sort of stuff. Like, could that Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday? And I think what it gave me was some sort of routine as well.
Yeah.
Because Tuesday you had to take training. So whether you were feeling good or not, your responsibility was there to push through that. The club knew that I was probably struggling. Stephen French was president at the time.
Yep.
I didn't tell him. I think my parents had sort of confined him that, and he was just like, we will help him to the 8th degree and the cricket is secondary, which, looking back, so grateful for Stephen. We actually, I scored a mountain of runs. But again, every Saturday you're exposed to a big fish, little pond, like couldn't hack it in the big time, easiest year for you. And I, like I said to you in the notes, I understand all of that. Like, I understand why I copped that, because, you know, they wanted to get me out and stuff, but I just look back and just wish I had turned around and said, I'm really struggling here. Please, like, just give me something.
Yep.
And so I got, it's led me about my technique or something, but other than being a failure, because I generally believed it, but yep. I don't blame anyone that I played against. It's just how it was. So
yep.
There was days where there was a certain day against Devonport, I got 100 and a lot. And then like the second I got home, bowling on the floor, like.
After scoring a ton.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. We had a quiz night that night at La Trobe that I was meant to go to, and I was just like to mum, I can't go. And she was like, well, you can not go, but I'm not lying about it anymore. I'm not going to lie to anyone. If they ask where you are, I'm telling them. And I was like so angry. I was like, nah. I felt so ashamed, like so embarrassed about my mental health. But I just said, well, I'm not going. And she just like, pretty tough conversation for a mother to have, I'm not going to lie. So I think Tristan Weeks, who was captain at the time, may have said to mum, like, I understand something's going on. Is there anything we can do to help? And that was so heartwarming. But yeah, I lived a pretty normal life. I used to go to training like all this, because my face would like go so red. I would like wear zinc all the time. Like
yep.
We have all the time, like all the time. Like, people would have been like, mate, what are you wearing zinc at training for? But to me, it was almost like makeup. It was covering up I could cover it on my body because yeah, obviously when I was training, a long sleeve shirt, always wear a long sleeve shirt, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, mum always joked that if I ever released a book, it should be called Behind the Zinc, because that just hid so much. Like, that was like go time. Like, when I put that on to go out and bat, I was fine.
Yeah.
To the outside world, inside, you know, mum had to push me out the door sometimes to go to cricket. It got to that point. Like,
yeah.
You got to go.
Just to go back quickly, this is one that I didn't sort of have on the rundown, but I know just in professional sport these days, there has been, just to talk about sledging, there has been like a lot of
crackdown now on sledges and what you can and can't say. Have you noticed that it has changed a little bit now with so much awareness now around mental health? And do you sort of speak to your players about that sort of thing? Because obviously, you know, back in the day it was open slather. You could say whatever you like, but nowadays there seems to be a lot more awareness around that sort of stuff.
Yeah, I think it's really, it shouldn't be hard, but it is, because you want your team, and I know I do, you want your team to be really close to the line, because it does, you want a hasty environment, you want it to be difficult for the batter to settle, you want presence in the field. But I always try and say that there's so many other ways that you can create a presence. You know, picking the ball up aggressively, throwing to the keeper hard, hitting the gloves, getting through your overs. But to answer your question, mate, absolutely changing now. I don't think, you can see in international cricket now, there's stump marks everywhere.
Yeah.
I think the higher level you go, the less sledging is involved. That would be my professional assessment. And I think even at lower levels now, it's becoming more and more policed. And I think it has to be.
Yep.
Like, sledge someone about their technique, or, you know, your bat's on a, you know, a shitty swing path, or your front leg looks like it's going to get blown off every ball. Like, I think that will never go away from the game. But the personal stuff, and I probably overstepped at times, and I've certainly been overstepped too when batting, but it's gone now. I just think that the end result, or the worst case result, would be that someone just has, that's it, that's their breaking point for them. Something gets said, they take their own life, or, you know, they can't come back from something that's what's said on a cricket field. And what you never know is the battle that someone's perhaps had, or the struggle, not battle's not the right word, the struggle someone's had to even get to the ground.
Yeah.
That's what I'm always asking myself. Do I need to say this? And the answer is always no. If you've got to ask, the answer's generally no.
Yep. You've usually answered it anyway, haven't you?
Yeah, exactly right, mate. Exactly.
Yeah. Just going back to your coaching of Latrobe, obviously with your anxiety and stuff, so you had to be a leader of the team and speak in front of the team and that sort of thing. Did you have, like, anxiety around that sort of stuff, or was that sort of your happy place? Were you comfortable in that environment?
Yeah, it's really tough because, like, all this stuff stemmed from cricket, but it was also a place that at times I felt really content. Like,
yep.
When I was batting in particular, I was only fixated on the ball.
Yep.
So I didn't have to worry about anything else. So it was almost like 50% heaven, 50% hell. That's what it felt like.
Yeah.
But it wasn't hell until the game was over. And then I felt like, oh, I'm just washed up playing for Latrobe. Like, couldn't crack it, couldn't do it, this and that. But I felt it. I felt anxiety at times speaking to the group. Definitely. Definitely. But, I mean, who wouldn't? I guess at that stage, no one I was playing with was overly confident in public speaking, because we hadn't been exposed to it. But
yep.
I think most of the players probably knew deep down that I was struggling with something, and they were so supportive. And we had a really good year. But, yeah, I did feel it at times speaking to the group.
Yep.
But I also felt like I was pretty knowledgeable on the game, so there was nothing really that was going to come out of the blue and trigger it, like, you know, what's the plan this time? I had all that stuff in my head when I was coaching Latrobe, and we were doing well at the time. But
yeah,
I did feel it. It was exhausting. It was really, really exhausting pretending to be okay for the best part of a year. That was really, really. And there's probably going to be guys that played that year and think, oh, I had no idea.
Yep.
It's funny because my dad was probably at a loggerhead, like, just didn't know what to do. And he ended up spilling the beans, really, that I was struggling with anxiety. And it turned out to be the best thing ever, because the person he told now, them and I are so close. Like, yep. But at the time, I didn't talk to him for like a month. I was like, how could you do that? How could you? That's my burden to bear. And now I'm just like, you know what? You got that right. Your judgment was spot on. Because that person that you told, we're like thick as now. We speak about coaching, life, family all the time. And it was based on that. So,
yep.
Yeah, I got anxious at the career club a lot, but just never really when I was batting. And it was batting in the gym that I felt at home at, because if you're really red in the face out there, it's because you're exhausted. Like,
looks like that's you're having how a simple crack.
It was. Yep, that's yep. how simple it was for me. The gym, through the psychologist, was something that I stepped into big time, because, yeah, if you've got a real red face there, or you're a bit sweaty and red, whatever, like, everyone is, because they're, you're having a crack. Like, it was almost like, geez, he's working hard.
Yeah.
Sometimes I just literally walked in there.
Yeah.
Like, I hadn't done anything.
Yep.
Just another amazing example of how our minds are.
Yeah. And you say there before about being around the club and certain people knowing. I think, again, that shows the importance of your mates. I know there's some people that wouldn't have known, as you said, what you were going through, but there were a couple that
that did put their arms around you, weren't there?
Yeah, there was. So Timmy Hayes, who I know you're close with, mate.
He'll love this.
Yeah, he'll be so pissed off that he's got some public hang time because he's just not that guy. But
no.
I remember he was sort of in and around the club at the time, playing the odd game. I was going to do some coaching with his boy Jack, and he invited me up for dinner, which wasn't abnormal, but like it wasn't a regular occurrence. We were quite close. He was very close with Ryan. Ryan was his first grade captain, and then I captained him a couple of times later. But and I just remember, I've been so anxious going there, which is madness now because the Hayes family, for anyone, they're the most beautiful human beings. Like, if you want to go somewhere and not get, if you want to go somewhere and not get judged, like go ride four wheelers and stuff with him. Like that is a judgment free zone, no matter what you could throw at him. And we were having dinner and stuff, and that's it. Like he just said, "What the hell's going on?" Pretty much, you know what he's like. He's so to the point, like you're not leaving until you kind of tell me what's going on. I think Mum had probably give him a little bit of insight. And it certainly wasn't a loaded plan. It wasn't like, I didn't feel like that. It was just, and I was just right. I was about to go home and we're kind of out on his patio and I just completely broke down. Like that was it. Tears everywhere. I don't know what the hell's going on with me. Like, and I'm getting help at this point. Like, is this, I don't know if I'm going to get better. I don't know if I'm going to live like this. And he just wrapped those big arms he's got around me and just said, mate, like, we'll work through this together. Like, I absolutely love you. And I just remember, like, when I talk about that now, it's a bit emotional because I just think at the time there was no quick fix from him. He wasn't like, oh, we're going to do this and going to get better. There was no false promise. It was just like, oh, I actually love you. Like, that was it.
Yeah.
He was perfect in that. So I know that he'll be pissed off that he got this hang time. But I hate to think that without him, I don't know what would have happened on that evening, to be honest with you.
And, you know, we need to give him a bit of recognition and, you know, to take the limelight off him a little bit. It just goes to show, though, that you don't have to be a psychologist or anyone that's qualified or anything like that. You just have to be somebody that cares and somebody that's consistent.
Yeah, I think you touched on it there. I think now, more so than ever, I think you just got to listen. Like, listen like a thief. Like, you got to listen. No one wants – I think the worst thing that can be done is, you know, yourself, if you go to someone with a problem and say, oh, you know, this is a really – simple example. I've only got $100. They say, oh, well, at least you got a car.
Yeah.
You're dismissing their problem.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, and I know a few people that just didn't have perhaps the tools that I opened up to. They're like, oh, well, at least you don't faint. And in my mind, I was like, I'll take fainting. Thanks.
Yeah.
I'll have fainting instead of a red rash.
Yeah.
Well, where do I sign up for the fainting anxiety?
Yep.
But dismissing the problem, I'm very, you know, I don't get everything right when people come to me with their problems. I can only speak from my experiences, but I'm very, very cautious on not, you know, dismissing their problem. If your biggest problem is your biggest problem, which with professional sports, which wasn't me, but you look at athletes now, you've only got to go online and people are like, oh, how can you be depressed with $10 million? Well, it's quite, your mind's the same. You just got more money.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's just beside the point, isn't it?
Exactly right. Exactly right.
And again, just coming back to your help that you did get with Helen. So why were you hesitant to do that to begin with? Because I'm assuming that it was suggested to you a few times and you must have batted it away for lack of a better term.
Yeah, that's a good term. I probably didn't want to accept it, to be honest, Brendan. I didn't want to accept that I had a problem. That was pretty much the crux of it, looking back. Denial, embarrassment perhaps. Avoidance, and just didn't want to accept that I had something that I needed help with. And I look back at that young kid and think, oh, I see why he didn't want to accept it. But I look back at that young kid now and I think, geez, it was pretty brave to go in the end. And it was through gritted teeth and that. But the second I accepted from her when she had laid down that you're going to live with this now, but it's manageable, the biggest weight come off my shoulders ever. Like, it was monumental. Like, whew, all right, this is what I'm dealing with. All right, Helen, tell me what now, the steps we can take, and with no promises, to gradually get better and better. And it took time, and it still takes time. Yep. I still have moments now of extreme anxiousness. Very rare now will I go into a full breakout of the rash, but it may just be on my chest or arms or neck or in a small bit, something that probably you guys would never notice or a random would never notice. You just think you got a bit of pink undertone.
Yeah.
But it took time. Like, yeah, I look back and think that I actually played some pretty good sport during this time, even when I go on to play at Kimber and win the medal with a lot of stuff in the background going on. Like, it's pretty, I'm pretty proud of getting through it, or at least learning the building blocks. But yeah, it was certainly, I didn't want to accept, mate. I didn't want to accept that I had a mental health, I won't say disorder, I want to say issue. And my brain, what Helen did was allowed me to understand exactly how your brain works around anxiety. And once, it was so foreign to me that I didn't, once you'd explain that, I kind of understood, you know, your flight versus fight. And that's what was happening to me. When I was stepping into an anxious environment, or I felt anxious, it was like my amygdala just like kicking into gear saying, we've got to get out of here. And then the adrenaline was pumping that quickly that my body had no way but to bring it out to the surface to cope with it. And I got a good understanding of what I was dealing with, and that I wasn't alone in it, and some coping mechanisms, and going to get help was the single-handedly the best thing ever.
That was the next thing that I was going to ask you. So obviously there'd be a lot of people listening to this that are going through struggles that some people might not even know about. You know, when you're sitting there, you know, on your own listening to this thing, it's, you know, sometimes you can get a lot of advice. Sometimes you can get too much advice. You know, you need to do this, you need to do this, you need to do this. If somebody is sitting there that is having, you know, major anxiety and they don't want to live like that anymore, what would you say is the first step? And obviously that can lead to other things, but what would be the first thing that you think they need to do to get on that path?
Speak to someone where you're not going to get any judgment. And that can sometimes be hard because you think everyone's going to judge you, but generally family, partners can be a bit difficult, I think, because obviously when you're with someone, like, your family can't choose you. Like, they're stuck with me. Do you know what I mean? Like, they can't, mum and dad can't be like, oh, you're at the auction. We're trading you in. I think that you just have to find someone that you trust the most in your life. And when the words come out of your mouth, you feel sick. Like, oh, I'm struggling with a mental health. But the second they're out of your mouth, the weight is lifted. So find someone you trust.
And sometimes, as you said, that can just be one of your mates, can't it? Just somebody that creates that environment that you're comfortable in. It's a safe environment for you.
Yep, couldn't agree anymore. And quite often it may be. Like, I was fortunate that probably I spoke to my parents a lot while I was away. So they probably picked up, like we said, that mum picked up on some cues and stuff. But I think a lot of people would first go to their mates. And sometimes that is over a beer. I think that sometimes is the perfect setting, you know, for a bloke to go, hey, mate, let's come down for a schooner or whatever, and that leads to the conversation. But just have any sort of conversation for as little or as long as you want. Quite often what I found was one sentence turned into 55.
Yep.
And then quite often what you get is, yep, I understand. I really struggle with that too. And you think, wow, like, I'm not going insane. I'm not the only person. I always think that in the end, the best help will be professional help, because they are equipped to deal with everything. But the first step is just get it off your chest. Yep. In any way. Sometimes I would just scream into my pillow, like the anger and anxiousness. I just wanted to scream it away. And that helped. And then longer down the line, but first step was just telling someone.
Yeah. And like you say, sometimes it's just finding out that you're not alone. But is that how it feels? Like, it feels like you're on an island on your own and you're the only person that's actually going through this in the whole world?
Yeah. Yeah, and it's stupid to say now. Like, on the flip side of it, like, looking back, but I just think, what an idiot. Like, I don't know how you got yourself into that thought process. But I generally thought, like, I was alone in the world in terms of when it was at its worst. I didn't want to tell anyone. I was embarrassed. I didn't want to accept it. And I also was putting this armor on to say, no, I'm fine. I'm going to uni and I'm coaching, doing this and I'm doing that. And that probably created made it worse for me, because the armor was so strong and probably at times over the top arrogant.
Yeah.
Particularly when I was playing cricket. I'm the first to admit that, like I said earlier, I swaggered around and I thought, that's it, I'm getting 100 against you blokes. Like, but that part of that was like this defense mechanism of, I am the man.
Yeah.
I was trying to convince myself that things were okay. But that's what it felt like, mate. I was stuck on an island, constantly nervous. Like, you've ever had too many coffees, like your body is sweating, pulsating. My hands would go first and I could feel it coming on, feel the rash. I just felt like everyone's eyes were on me saying, like, what a failure. That's how I felt at the time.
Yeah. Yep. And another part of your story, which you sent through to me, obviously, you know, going through enough, you know, with your anxiety and having to deal with that as well. You touched on there before that you went back down to, was it Kingborough that you went and played at, you said, down south? Yep.
Yeah.
And, and, you know, probably had your best ever season, but you also had a major, well, I'll let you tell the story, but you also had a major incident down there and it wasn't even playing cricket, was it?
No, it wasn't. So, yeah, like, look, when I played at Kingborough, I was getting on top of the anxiety stuff. It was still very much there, and I was still working through it, still putting the steps in place that I had from Helen and doing that stuff daily.
Yep.
I was really happy off the field. I had a girlfriend at the time. I had a really good job that the club had helped me source. I was in a leadership role as senior assistant coach and obviously first grade captain. And, yeah, I had a really, really good season that year. Obviously I won the Rodwell medal, which for me was almost like this was it. When I went to Kingbred, I said to myself, this is it, like this is my last crack to, I'm 26 at the time, to play professional cricket. And I probably was fueled by a little bit of, you know, I'd been left out of the Tasmanian second team squad. It's like a development squad. I'd been left out of that. I hadn't played very well the year before, and I was fueled by a little bit of, here we go, I can show you, you know, I can do this. I was really content off the ground. Won the medal. I didn't keep the medal. I gave the Rodwell medal to Ray Reid's family when he passed away, who was someone that was curator of the tribe. I'm not sure if you ever met him, but curator from the moment I was 8 until, well, yeah, 26. So the Rodwell medal is buried with him, because he, when he was dying, like he was very sick. I just remember him saying, like, I want to see you score one more 100. Like, I could just hear the words down the line, man. It makes me cry, but every 100 now for the rest of my life is always a little look to the sky for two reasons now. Obviously, we'll touch on later, but he is a big one. He taught me how to bat. He taught me respect, hard work, the pride he took in his work at La Trobe. I know they've named the shed after him, but I just thought that was a little thing that I could do, and it's nice to know that it's sitting somewhere. But, yeah, and in that winter, after winning the medal, I decided to play football, break up the seasons and stuff, and I've been invited back to the Cricket Taz Academy for the winter session. So I was like, all right, he kind of had to swallow humble pie a little bit there, and I'm back like Eminem. And, yeah, it was the last sad day of football for me before cricket took over. We played Clarence down at Richmond. Obviously, Bel Reeve was out of service, and I went back with the flight, and cue the jokes of like bloke saying, you only ever went back with the flight once. And I did only went back once, and a guy come up from the halfback line, and I got concussion, so it hit me across the bridge of the eye here. My head kind of bounced off the ground, but it wasn't. It's like a very quick knockout, and I'm back on my feet, and it's kind of like delayed concussion. And I just remember, like, the whole world started to spin, go black, and I was just like, "She was in the. I'm in the hands of the trainer," and next thing I know, I woke up in the in and out of consciousness. Obviously, I wake up in the MRI machine in the Royal Hobart Hospital, which is like they strap you in. Obviously, I don't know if you've had one. They strap you in. It's all white. It's like,
yep.
Doof, 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 doof. And I was like, this is it. This is. I thought this is heaven. I really did. I just woke up and was like, what on earth is this?
Yeah.
Like, you see movies. It's all white. They pass over.
Yeah.
And look, it wasn't at the time when I come through the next day. I had some. There was some memory loss of. I'd been at training that morning. So the games used to be like 12:30. So I would train cricket till like 6:30 till 9:30, then drive down there. And I can't remember being at training or getting to the ground or, there's about 2 weeks in advance that I can't remember too much. But it was a difficult time. The rehab was drastic. And probably the biggest thing for me and the biggest concern of everyone was that when you get knocked out or you deal with concussion, it hits your emotional scale back to zero. So for me, it was like, oh, I've done all this work. Oh, I was just gutted. I was just like hand in head. I've done all this work, you know, like to get to a point where I accepted the anxiety thing. I was managing it. I was having pretty much a anxiety-free life to go and get knocked out playing football, which people had warned me not to play. For, they were like, oh, you're getting into cricket. And I was like, no, it's really fun. And I'm just like, bang, back to zero.
Yeah.
Anxious. What are people going to think? Can I go back to cricket? Can I go back to football? Had a heap of specialists, lived with my brother for a while. Again, where I had like a relapse where I went to the bathroom, kind of got all black, fell back, hit my head on his sink, back to hospital. It's like 2 weeks after. had some issues with, like, my heart had skipped to an irregular beat due to concussion. So went to thousands of appointments, wore a monitor, and this is over a long period of time now, probably the next 6 weeks. I'm trying to figure out, they're trying to figure out the specialist exactly what it is, whether it's head now or it's heart. And then my eyes, I just remember I was going blurry. So obviously your eyes go down on an axis cross and vertical, and mine had started to jump like this.
Yeah.
And sideways it jumped. So I did about, God, it would have been about 30 eye rehab sessions. I'm just in this dark room and there's just this light on the wall, this red light, and it goes up and down. And I just follow it. And they got these goggles now with cameras that are watching your eyes, and they're just studying my vision. And eventually it come back to pretty good. I still struggle sometimes now. It's really hot. And I start to get migraine, but yeah, I'd gone back, knocked back to zero emotionally, which was really, really tough for me. But again, got ruled out of the following summer. So I've seen three or four specialists that I pretty much went to a doctor, any doctor that would have me. Just I wanted them to say you can play. Like that's what I wanted to hear.
Yep.
And they all just said, I don't think it's safe right now while your brain is in healing mode for you to play competitive sport of any kind. So I kind of had a pretty open and honest conversation with mum and dad. I was like, look, I can't really sit in Hobart where all my friends play cricket. I'm going to be miserable. So it was, again, the mental versus the physical dangers of if I gave it up, would I be mentally vulnerable again? But I decided, you know what, at that time we're in the pandemic. So Tassie in Queensland had a bubble. You could take money out of your super. I took some money out of my super and I packed all my stuff up and thought I'm going to do my rehab on a Gold Coast beach, and I haven't been home since.
This episode of the pod would not be possible without the support of Sam and the team at Infinite Joinery and Design. If you're like me and normally need these guys to come in after you stuff up your latest home renovation, here's an idea. Get them in first and save the hassle. Specialising in new home joinery fit-outs, renovations, kitchens, laundries, wardrobes, vanities and solid timber work and project management, Infinite have 3D design software, and Sam alone has over 20 years' experience in joinery and project management. He knows his stuff. Located at 6 Bay Drive, Coiber, or you can find them on Facebook and Instagram, or contact Sam at 0429 291 008, or you can email Sam at infinitejoineryanddesign.com. So don't be like me, get the experts in first and save yourself some money and a fear stressing down from the better half.
So, mate, obviously you said you moved up to Queensland, and we'll get into that, but just touching back on again, I suppose that not making the Tasmanian side, obviously that was such a big goal of yours. Like, did you ever get any feedback as to why you weren't sort of progressing? Because obviously you were doing as much as you could at your end.
Yeah. Yes. Would I have liked more? Most certainly. I think at the time, again, and we spoke about, I'll say off air, but when we weren't recording about, cricket is such a game where you have to be scoring runs at the right time. There's two coaches during those years. So one left, another one who had a different playing style was employed. So I probably fell in the cracks between two differing systems, one who probably suited my style, one who was probably never going to, but I get asked that a lot, mate, to be honest. I get asked a lot of questions why all the time, and sometimes it's quite innocent. Why didn't you play for Tassie? I remember how I had one meeting with the head coach at the time, and obviously I can't release his name, but it was pretty much along the lines of, you've got to be a really good bloke and you've got to score a lot of runs. And I was kind of like, well, you're calling me a poor bloke because I'm scoring a heap of runs.
Backhanded insult.
Yeah. You've got to be a good bloke, good team man, and you've got to score runs. I thought, well, I'm doing one of those things. I think I'm a good team man. I know the players that were playing at the time thought that, and I was close with a lot of those guys. Like, some of them are my best mates, so I know they have my back if it ever my name ever come up in terms of being a good team man. So, look, I don't know. I think sometimes that. From a finance, now that I'm in a position I am now as director, and guys may get paid or guys may not get paid, or certainly dealing when I coached the Gold Coast in terms of you're exposed then to how Queensland were putting their list together. I'm more okay with it now after sitting on the other side of the fence, how they put their list together. Because I was 26 years old, I was Tasmanian, didn't have any interest from other states. And at the end of the day, it's a business. If you're going to pay a guy, 80 grand a year, you're going to want some sort of return on that. Would I have played a couple of games if they gave me a contract? Maybe, but I was probably going to be 21st guy on the list. So it's like, well, I can understand now more than ever after being on the other side, like I said, why they didn't say his, you know, 2 years at having a crack, because it wasn't going to go anywhere. There was no interest from elsewhere. Am I okay with that? I really am now. I don't think now I look back on everything, one game, and it would have meant the world to me. It would have meant that the sacrifice was maybe worth it.
Yeah.
To have a baggy green in terms of the Tassie Tiger, but nothing would have changed. And I only learnt that when I couldn't play with concussion, because not a single thing in my life changed once I, you know, was out in the media, the advocate or whatever, and, you know, he's ruled out for the summer. Nothing changed. Not how people approached me, not how people spoke to me, not how people cared for me, not how people loved me or people viewed me. And that in itself was the golden moment in my life that I just thought, you know what? If I go back to the game, I'm going back because I want to, not because I need it anymore. And it sounds like a bad breakup. Like, that's literally how it sounds.
Yep.
But that's how it felt. And I remember going down to have a few beers in La Trobe just after I was living with mum and dad, obviously healing from concussion and other stuff, and going down to have a few beers. And that was the first time in a long time that I felt that I wasn't anxious going down there.
Yep.
After I'd been ruled out. And I told mum in the backyard the next day, like, I'm hungover. I've been having beers with, like, La Trobe blokes, like, just great human beings. And she generally just cried, like, I've been waiting for this day for so long.
Yeah.
Like, there's just genuine tears at the clothesline. Like, I'll never forget.
Yeah.
I'll never forget how good she was throughout that whole period.
Yeah.
But that moment, like, that's great. I'm taking that to my grave. She's just like, I'm so happy for you. Like, I'm so proud. And I've been waiting this day for the life. And, yeah, then I just packed up and decided to go to Queensland. Well, not much of a plan, really. I had X amount of money. I thought, oh, well, worst comes to worst, I'll just come home.
Yep. And you got a coaching gig up there, so that wasn't teed up before you went up there. You just went road, so basically, all, just see what had happened.
Yeah. The next 18 months is all by, like, I think fate. I'm a believer in that. I went up there. I knew I had some extended. I was living with some extended family that we hadn't really met much, but we had a connection through the game. And they were involved at Broadbeach, which is like La Trobe's level to in relation to the Greater Northern Raiders now.
Yep.
And I went down there just to do some one-on-one coaching, mainly just, I was going to get, you know, a bit of cash in hand, that sort of thing. There's a few accountants in here probably thinking, Jesus. and it was mainly to live off, you know, to have a good time. And I was doing my rehab and I managed to get in close with a guy that played there, who happened to be director of cricket at a big private school, who just said, oh, why don't you come? You know, you got Saturdays off now, you can't play. Come to our year 10s. It's a really big year for them in terms of their career. Next year, they go into our first 11 team. At school, I think you'll be a wealth of knowledge. And I was all right. And at that time, it was like training on a Tuesday and a game for half a day on Saturday. And then you can go to the beach and, you know, do your rehab and stuff. So it was perfect. Within 2 weeks of being there and loving the cricket system, like, this school had, like, it had everything, nets, gym, pool, all the more cricket balls and players. He just said, oh, how would you like to work at the school full time as a resident master? Now, I had no experience with boarding school. I didn't go to boarding school. I didn't know many people that had ever been.
Yep.
I was like, what on earth is a resident master? Like, well, basically, you get this self-contained unit and you become a big brother to 30 grade sevens.
Yep.
And you look after them. You go on activities and stuff. And I was a bit hesitant, but I was just like, honestly, at the time, I was hearing, like, free rent and food. I was like, well, I've got X amount of money, it's running out.
Where do I sign up?
Why not? Yeah, where do I sign up? And that would turn out to be the best decision I ever made in life, in just taking that job. Like, it was, gave me so much perspective, met so many people. Like, work was like on a Sunday, going to Wet n Wild with 30 grade sevens. Like, that wasn't work. That was, yep. I used to push the kids out of the way and go on the rides myself.
Like, you're the biggest kid of all.
Yeah. I remember the first job in inverted commas, or the first trip I ever did was to this big water park down by the ocean.
Yep.
And it was like a inflatable obstacle course. And I just stood up, like old gladiator days, I just stood on the top, lobbing grade sevens off the edge of it. That was my work. That's what it was.
Yep.
And they loved it. And I built up some relationships. And to get back onto how I ended up at Gold Coast, it was I applied for the under 17 job there, just thinking that was Sundays, it was only eight games, And then out of the blue, randomly, this all happens within the first month of being there, really. Their head coach at the time resigns for whatever reason. So, and the president had asked, would you be interested in being coach of the club? And I'm like, I might be a bit out of my depth here, but it just simmered in the back of my head. Maybe this was fate. I was pretty clear that, look, I still struggle with concussion at times. I'm not probably going to be able to play all the time, or maybe not at all. I just said, all right. I was a bit tentative, won the interview. I remember the interview was like, well, it was pretty much like, how are you going to, they had a good list, expected to win. How are you going to, win as a grand final? And my response was just like, it's a little acronym I've got now. It's ACE, so attitude, care, enjoyment, and love. And they were like, what? What? I was like, nah. Like, that's all we need. If the list is that good,
yep,
that's all we need. You can front up with a good attitude, care for the players. I'll care for the players at every fibre of my body. They'll care for me. They'll care for each other. And enjoyment. If you're not doing it with a smile on your face, they're going to think it's a chore. And, yeah, just fell into it there, and the rest is sort of history.
Yep. But you had a pretty successful year, didn't you?
Yeah, it was awesome, mate. We won about six finals. So we won a first and second grade one-day final on the same day. We won our T20 final at the Gabba. The under-17s won. We made all the top three grades, made the finals of the Red Bull, and lost, which was upsetting. But I just remember thinking, particularly on the one-day final day, by that time, I had another little relapse with concussion where I hit my head on the stairs at school, just like walking up, hit my head on the stairs. And at this boarding school, there's a big health center. So I went up there and sort of explained my situation with concussion and that sort of thing. And they were like, okay, go down to this GP. Went to the GP and it was a female GP. And she's like, I know the perfect person for you to go and see. They're a psychologist. And obviously, I won't say his name because it ends in rather sad circumstances. But I then formed a relationship with this bloke around. It started as I thought with concussion. Sometimes I was imagining the symptoms. It sounds really weird, like Jason Bourne. Like I thought I was going insane. Not now with anxiety, but with like, oh, am I getting head spins? Is that real? Like, is it me? Every time I hit my head, do I then placebo effect? Oh, I've got a headache. Or so it started with that. And what form was like the most beautiful of friendships in the end. And we spoke about everything around fear, love, family. Our relationship went from then, professional to personal, in terms of we would talk a lot. This bloke got me so much access to professional teams like the All Blacks. He had done some work with them. And it started with concussion. We worked through that and the things I could do to mitigate the long-standing effects of that. And then my coaching philosophy and how I was as a person, everything I've been through, how I come around to make ACE. And, he passed away. I remember I'm driving to training on a Tuesday and I get a call. It's like, you're not going to be able to see him again. I was just like, what? Like, he's gone. And I was just like, absolutely shattered. Like, we had this when I used to go and see him, we had this joke, like we used to live where people holiday, like when the sun was at its highest point, like how good is this, like clear skies. And when we won the one day final, I was really rattled by the loss of him, and I still haven't dealt with that now. There's still times that I want to bang back down the door and send him a text or a call and say, what do you think about this, or why am I acting this way to this situation, or how do I best handle this? And so I've lost that. I can admit now to the world that I haven't dealt with his loss very well. But so I found out through a few people that there was just like a little note on his desk before he'd passed away saying, go Dolphins, which is obviously the Gold Coast Dolphins where I was coach of. So that far out, man, like I could break down and cry about it now, which I think more men should do for the record, but I remember the one-day final, we played the perfect game. Like 280, a couple of boys played really well. So I just remember, like, it's the ninth wicket, we're about to win, and the sun is at its highest point. And I just thought, like, thank you so much. I had these fielding sunnies on. My eyes are swelling up. I was like, God, I hope we take this last wicket because I'm going to ball here. Like, just thank you so much. And now every time the sun is at its highest point, no matter where I am, I always say to him, thank you so much for everything. And there's not a day goes by, mate, where I don't just think maybe I spoke about myself too much or was too self-indulgent and didn't ever ask how he was travelling. But the relationships you make has always been, for me, why cricket has been such an important thing now. And I look back through all the adversity and am so grateful for the people that I was able to meet and the people I can help in the future. But all that stuff with the coaching at the Gold Coast, it just fell into place. We had a super year, and there's so much more to it, how we built the success and stuff. But yeah, I thank him every day for what he did for me.
Yeah, well, like you say, having that sun at the highest point's a nice reminder. And I suppose especially being in England, like, you'd really, really enjoy it when the sun's out and at its highest point there, wouldn't you?
Yeah, exactly right, mate. We've had a beautiful summer, and sometimes I think that's him. Yeah. I think that's him looking over me saying, you know, I know you love the weather, you know, hot, stuffy rooms make me anxious.
Yeah.
And he knew that. So sometimes I think, mate, you know, they'll have the doors open and a breeze for you. And it's a big thank you. But it does make me sad speaking about him. Sad and happy is how I describe it. I lost someone that was really close to me, and I felt like I was close to him. But I'm almost smile because I was fortunate enough to have that.
Yeah.
A lot of people go through life perhaps not having that closeness and openness with someone, but, you know, we are where we are. And he always used to say that to me, you front up with what you've got, where you are in any situation with a smile on your face and your chest out, Trent, you'll be okay.
Yeah. And obviously, you know, so you're over in England. How did that come about?
Yeah, that came about just by like mutual connection, really. The cricket, the cricket world is so small. There was a couple of people that had been over here before. I knew what direction I wanted to go in terms of cricket. Don't get me wrong, I don't love playing anymore because I've been through such a ride. No matter what I do, I still do get a bit down if I don't get any runs. Not so much anxious wise anymore. I just get a bit down on myself. The best times I've had in the game was certainly the first 3 months of the Dolphins where I didn't play. I just coached. You're able to look at the game in a different, less emotional sense. But to hear, just coming out through mutual connections, really. So there was an opportunity to be director of coaching, which, again, was daunting for me because I'm not the most organized person. I tend to go fly off instinct and heart a lot.
Yep.
So it was a good... I thought it was going to be good on my resume moving forward. And again, there was some development to be had here in my own self, and learning some skills that I perhaps don't have. I think I'm a good career coach in terms of technical aspect, but yeah, just come through mutual. And I just spoke to Paul Martin, who's chairman here, and pretty much exactly the same things we've spoke about here and that Nick spoke about on his podcast. You know, care for the players, attitude, care, enjoyment. I said this is my philosophy. I'm not really in the headspace for changing that. I think this works deeply. Professionalism. And he said, I'm with you, mate. And listen, one WhatsApp call. That's exactly what we need. We indirectly said, we're not going to interview anyone else. Like, you are the man. Agreed to terms. And got on a plane, and here I am. My visa was 5 weeks delayed. Obviously, all the war in the Ukraine and stuff. So I killed some time for a bit. Landed on a Thursday, straight into work. And had loved every second of it. Very well supported, well looked after. There'll be guys that from here, from the Greek club that listen to this, I'm sure, you know, when we give it a share and stuff, and probably think, wow, I had no idea. Like, when you just see someone in cricket mode all the time, I stand up in front of the group now with no anxiety in front of them. They'll be like, wow, I would never have picked that, which I think is the magic in the message.
Yeah.
Sometimes you just don't know. Absolutely. But, yeah, it just come through mutual connections, mate. And it was a bit of a gamble. But landed on my feet here, working at Risley Pie as well as a cover teacher and in special needs, which gives me, I look back now on how I was a bit of a spoiled brat when I think about how I handled all this. You know, I'm a bit ashamed because I work with some kids that, you know, their legs don't work or they've got bigger issues and worse issues. Not that you should compare, but they, you know, their life, they're never going to be able to make that any more manageable in terms of their legs never going to come back. And I'll get a real grounding from that.
Yep. I was going to say that. Do you learn stuff from them? Are there major learnings that you've taken away from working with those kids?
Yeah. You got to. Kids are so innocently brutal and honest. I think it's so refreshing.
Yep.
Like, you know, there's one particular kid, And I spend a lot of days with him. He's in a wheelchair, so obviously it's fully accessible. There's lifts and stuff, but I spend a lot of time with him in his PE class and stuff. And he just has this great outlook on life. Always a smile, always a cheeky comment. Like, takes the piss out of my accent all the time. Like, you know, just a normal kid who just happens to be in a wheelchair. That was born that way. His legs don't work. Fronts up with what he's got every day. There's times where, you know, he may be a bit low. But I learn every day to be grateful for the sun coming up, the opportunities that I've been able to carve out, and really proud of, I guess, where I'm from and the things that I've been able to achieve to date. Every day I'm there with those kids, life is beautiful. It really, really is. They give me a perspective that I didn't think I needed, but it wasn't until I started working that I thought, that selection meeting on Thursday night was tough, but when you front up on a Friday and this kid, geez, I'd like to be able to get out of this wheelchair like that. That puts it all in perspective, I think, mate.
Yeah. And I was going to ask you, so obviously being over there away from family and things, what sort of support networks apart from the club do you have around you? Do you have people over there that you can go and talk to if you're struggling, or what sort of supports have you put in?
Yeah, I'm very close with Paul Martin, who's chairman, so he's aware of some of this, probably not the depths of it all, but he's someone that I go to first, and I have done. Like, I've needed a day to reset, but there are some guys that I played some cricket with in Tasmania and on the Gold Coast, scattered around England. So we try and catch up once every fortnight. Mainly for me, it's to check in. They're younger than I am, and I know at times a couple have been struggling, being away, they haven't performed, and I can see that from a mile away. Now I've got a good eye for something's drastically changed in his personality. So, mate, let's catch up in London.
Yep.
Generally, it's a coffee, or we might even go lift weights together, and thrash it out that way. And they generally come around by the last exercise and say, yeah, I'm really missing home, or, you know, some have a girlfriend at home, I'm really struggling with my performance, but I feel like, pardon the pun, the weight has been lifted by, just speaking to you. So I sometimes speaking to them about what they're struggling with actually is like my own form of therapy as well. And that it's a bit of a taboo word that, like, not many people would say, yeah, I go to therapy, but I can't wait to build a relationship with someone again in that way when the time is right to be able to share coaching philosophy or why I react this way but I've got a good network here. You're only ever a phone call away. I speak to my parents maybe once a week, obviously when you're here, and then you're trying to come back home at some point. You've got some more things to organize, like financially and car and stuff, and, you know, jobs that perhaps have been one and done in Tassie and stuff. So I'm pretty well equipped now to deal with my emotions. I think writing down or just accepting, I've got so much better at accepting. I'm upset now. I'll write it down. This is why. Or I'm anxious about X, Y, Z. And just doing that almost doesn't alleviate. It's never going to be gone. And I just become an avid reader. That's my escape is reading a book.
Yep. Yeah, which you can. You can get lost in a book sometimes, can't you? Just sort of take your mind off things.
100%.
Yep.
100%. I'll read sometimes on Saturdays before I bat if I'm overly wired, or, you know, I can feel myself getting past the point of nervous energy to becoming anxious, where I'm not in control, perhaps, of my emotions. I'll generally just lay in the change rooms and have a read. And obviously you hear the appeal and stuff, and you think, oh, I'm next in. There's been times where I've walked out of bat, I haven't really known what the score was at the time.
Yep.
It's like, all right, let's get down to business now. But reading for me has been, almost like a lifesaver.
Yeah.
Read some good books.
Yep. How do you reckon you're going to go today after doing this podcast? Are you likely to be amped up, or is this going to be therapeutic?
Yeah.
Are you going to be nice and calm? Or?
Yeah, I think... when you messaged me about coming on, there was honestly a little bit of like, oh, I wonder what people are going to think. But I thought, you know, what did that kid that was struggling at 22 need so much? And maybe it was someone from his same town to go on a podcast and say, oh, I struggle with this too. And I hope one person, that's all I hope for, one person. They don't have to reach out to me. I may never know, right? I may never know. But I just hope one person thinks, yeah, you know, that happened to him. He's worked through it. You know, I don't like to say I've had a career, because I played about 8 games of second 11 cricket where you get a bit of money and stuff. But, you know, I've been able to achieve some things that I'm really fond of. But I hope that someone out there just says, you know what, when mum comes back or my mate comes back, I'm going to tell them this is what's going on in my head. And that's all I'm hoping for. It's not, I do feel that people will be like, oh, what's this boy got to be worried about? Like, you know, good on you, mate. You got anxious because you were good at cricket. Like, chin up. Like, I still think that, but the bigger good for me to have to wear that is that I may help someone, one person. But in terms of today, I think there'll be a little bit of emotional drainage. It feels so good, mate, to have shared this with you on such an important podcast. But the sun is shining, and I know every time I take guard now and the sun is beaming down, I've got like a little helper in the sky in him. And I just think, you know, best foot forward, whatever happens. Sun comes up tomorrow, and so much to be grateful for.
Yep. Excellent. Mate, last question I've got for you. What's the best piece of advice you've been given, and where did it come from? And I normally give people a heads up, and I forgot to send it through to you, but does something come to mind?
That's right. no one cares what you know until they know you care.
Yep.
And I think my brother told me it. He would have stole it from somewhere, probably claimed it as his own. But I probably, when I was a younger coach, went in with all this knowledge and put it on everyone. I put it on them like, I'm going to prove that I'm a good coach because I know all this stuff. Now I'm almost like, well, I don't think anything needs to be said here. They just need an arm around the shoulder. I'm with you, mate. I'm with you. We'll get through this, whether it's form or mental health or family or breakups. No one knows. No one cares what you know until they know you care. And that, for me, is relationship building right now. You know, you're not going to open up to me if you think that I don't care. Like, so much, you see it a lot. Like, hey, mate, how you going? Oh, I'm all right. Oh, geez, that's good. It's almost like a, you know, Macca's drive through. How you going? Yeah, good. Thanks, and I this.
Yeah.
It's the follow up for me. Try and bring a pretty wholesome environment into the career clubs that I'm in or the school. And if guys, I would rather guys and girls now send me a message saying, look, I've had a really low day for whatever reason. They don't have to give me a reason. I'm not going to come to training because I just don't feel like it. I would rather that than someone comes to training, they're moping around X, Y, Z, and it brings the whole, you know, geez, what's going on with Brendan over there? That environment into it. So,
yeah.
Showing you care, I think you'll get the best out of your players as people first and foremost, like Nick said, people first, athlete second.
Yeah. Well, mate, thanks very much for your time. And as I say, I'm sure that you're going to go on and score a ton now on the back of this. So.
let's hope so. You know, an hour or so of my time is nothing in the big scheme of things. I hope that people out there do get some sort of assistance in terms of it can get better. The forefront of mental health, I think, is sometimes pretending you're someone you're not. So if there is someone out there struggling, my Facebook, my line is always open to have a private discussion. It's not going to go anywhere else. And I just think, thank you, mate, for the work you're doing on this, the podcast you've had before me. Look, I hope that I can light some sort of candle to those and share some sort of insight from someone who grew up in, you know, a pretty small place in Latrobe, and you know, spread some sort of positivity around a mental health. Isn't always doom and gloom. You got to hit rock bottom, I think, before you can go up. But yeah, like I said, mate, you're doing such a good thing, and I'm very proud to have been on your podcast and share some stuff with you.
No worries, mate. And I think it's one of those things with the podcast too, is you might not know how many people it is helping. It's like sometimes until you actually go and ask people, oh, why did you make that change? Oh, well, you know, I heard Trent Keep talk on a podcast and that sort of thing. Like, you just don't know who you're helping. And I think also that's an important message for people out there too, to keep checking in with each other and keep caring for each other, because even though on the surface it might not look like you're making a difference, they might go away that day and you might be the only person that actually asked them how their day was. So I think that's a really important thing as well.
It takes no effort for a candle to light another candle. That's what I like as well. Try and brighten someone else's day. You just don't know. You just never know. Ask why all the time. Why is this person acting this way?
Yeah.
You just don't know. You may save a life. And I know there's been times where, you know, people have saved people's life, or just, you know, let's go for a coffee or whatever. Yep. You really don't know anymore, mate. But yeah, like I said, so pleased to have been asked to come on, and hope someone gets something out of it.
Like I say, hopefully you go and make 100, but I know that even if you don't, the sun will still be up at its highest point. The sun will still be shining.
Yeah,
mate. So there's plenty of worse things in life, isn't there?
That's exactly right, mate. I've failed more and more in cricket now. I just sometimes I walk off with a big smile on my face and just think, oh, this fucking game.
Very impressive individual, and very courageous to tell his story, all in the hope that it may help someone else. I think the key takeaways from Trent's story, as I said in the intro, is that you never know if someone's struggling. Sometimes it may not be evident on the outside, so it makes it more important to care and constantly check in with each other, because 9 times out of 10 the person might be fine, but it might be that one time that speaking to you opens them up to moving forward in a positive way. As we've said on the pod before, check in on your mates and family, and this story again highlights the importance of finding someone to talk to if times are tough. Thanks again to Trent for his time, and as a side note, Trent went on to score 117 that day for the Mighty Squirrels and gave a nod to the sun at its highest point. Thanks again for listening. For anyone out there having their own struggles who wants to have a chat to someone, you can call Lifeline on 131114, Men's Line Australia on 1300 789978, or you can call Beyond Blue on 1300 224636.